I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
This is Captain Pikachu.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 277th installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we are talking about Star Trek Discovery Season 4. The whole damn thing, all 13 episodes as one big chunk. And with us to discuss the season of Star Trek, the one and only Captain Pikachu.
Pika Pika.
So should we call you Pika for short? Is that an appropriate abbreviation?
It works.
But your name there, it's obvious. It might not be obvious to some people, but it is a combination of Captain Pike and the iconic Pokemon character Pikachu.
Yes, very much so.
Who people remember was briefly captain of the Discovery in Season 5.
Maybe I'll be captaining Discovery in the future.
I mean,
it does seem to be a revolving. I think Sonequa Martin Green has got it on lock. But
now
I don't
after
know.
Season five, what after
she's got a couple of more decades. You know, we'll let her do another half century, and then I can take over.
We know that they added some additional stuff to give the season five more of an ending. So what if they end up destroying the Discovery? What if she goes out in the last episode? That's possible.
But it is possible. That's, you know, one thing, right? One thing that, like, if you ever do something like that, you do kind of, you wrap it up. You mean that you can't, like, nobody can come in and screw it up. Nobody can make changes. It becomes what it was.
They can always roll out the Discovery B, you know? That's kind of like the Star Trek tradition. But just blow up your ship. It's okay. Starfleet will give you a new one. No consequences to that.
But they won't do that.
I feel like this one is particularly harder, though, because Zora is the Discovery. So
you'd be killing
a sentient being.
Yeah, and it's just, it goes against the show's ethos. There's no way they end on a downer note. There's just no way.
Well, Pika, let me ask you, what, like, inspired you to use that handle or that screen name?
Actually, it's well, I kind of have to blame the fact that Anson Mount, when he came in as Captain Pike, was just making a lot of faces and that looked like it was matching a Pikachu. And at the time, I had just watched Detective Pikachu, so I think it was very fresh in my brain, and so it was just the two of them looked exactly the same, similar expressions. I'm sure I've shared that compilation picture somewhere on Twitter. I'll probably post it again on my Twitter.
Would love to see this.
Yeah, I have a whole entire, like, collage that's just, like, all the matching facial expressions.
The surprised expression is the one I really want to see, and that one that I sometimes see is a GIF where Pikachu is doing like this with his face. I want to see like some version of Pike that's, you know, anyway.
You know, well, you might have to ask the actor to do that. You know, we'll have
that would be quite the request. Yeah, it's going to be a cameo.
I mean, he's embraced the Pikachu thing, so, you know, if you request it of him, I think he might be able to oblige in that request.
Maybe we can get him to make some more Pikachu faces. I'll have to see if I can run that by him at a convention or something. If I see him at a con in the near future, maybe someone can ask him during like a Q&A panel or something. Ask Anson. You know, actors really love that when you like ask them to perform. You know, in the middle of the panel,
Jesus.
Like. Like, ask Shatner to scream Khan for you.
Get us banned.
I don't know. Maybe one day they'll premiere a season of Strange New Worlds in Austin at South By, like they're doing next week with Discovery Season 5. It's actually going to premiere here in Austin with me and Dave, so.
I wish I had a teleporter thing, or like one of those personal transporters.
Oh, man.
It'd be really nice to just get to Austin.
Oh, you're not, I don't know if you want me to say, like, what part of the world you're in, but you're not terribly far.
No, I'm actually not. I'm, like, so close, so that's why it hurts me that I can't be there. It's, like, so close yet so far.
That's why we need them to come back and premiere Strange New Worlds there, so hopefully it goes yeah, well.
I agree.
More on that in a minute, just but before we talk about tonight's topic, a little bit of housekeeping. I want to give a huge thank you and shout out to the wonderful Text Trek Patreon supporters who make the weekly live show possible. So thank you so much, Starfleet Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Dog, Geek Filter, Earl Grey Trekkie, Quark Spar, Stephanie Durantas, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A, Joel Valisok, and our anonymous supporters. We like to celebrate with a monthly watch party. So you can come into the Patreon at whatever tier you're able to help out at. You can come in as little as $2 a month, and that will get you into the monthly watch parties. We have some additional perks as well, but $2 a month, you can join us on March 16th. That's our next watch party. That's coming up in about a week, Saturday afternoon, March 16th. We're going to be watching in celebration of St. Paddy's Day, the great Irish representation handled so well, not a single problematic thing in it, but the TNG episode Up the Long Ladder.
Oh boy.
Yeah. You know what? It's gonna be fun. We're gonna have a good time with it though.
That is. The watch parties are always fun because if you watch something dumb, it's fun. And if you watch something good, it's fun. So.
That's actually true. That's 100%.
Yeah, so a great gang shows up for those. And I encourage people to check those out. If you're in the Patreon, you haven't attended those, and you want to, make sure that you're in the TextTrek Discord server and just send me a DM in there, and we'll get you in there. But next one coming up on Saturday, March 16th, Up the Long Ladder. But yeah, in addition to things happening soon, like I mentioned, the Discovery premiere is Monday, March 11th. So I got my invite confirmation from Paramount today. I assume that they'll let me in the door. I'm still like kind of skeptical, but I will attempt to be in attendance. Hopefully everything works out, but we will have a report next week from the premiere event, and Rachel is hopefully going to be in attendance with me, and they're going to show the first two episodes along with a Q&A with a lot of the cast, as well as showrunners Michelle Paradise and Alex Kurtzman. And I've never seen Alex Kurtzman anywhere. I've never been in like the same room as him before, so that I don't know if I'll get to ask him a question, but that'll be, I don't know, I just kind of like when I meet these, you're not even like meeting these people, but just seeing them, it's like, oh, some photons bounced off of them and went into my eye. That's kind of cool.
You know what they look like if you ever need to track them down now?
That's how one of our audience members, Joel, actually, he described that to me at like Star Trek Las Vegas when I was like, you know, I can't really explain it, but I just want to stick around in here, you know, long enough to like see Shatner and on stage with the new Kirks from Strange New Worlds. And it's okay. I saw like all three of them together. We can go now. He's like, yeah, you just want to see like the, you know, the photons bounce off of them and go in your eye. You know, it's kind of like, it's like
a real.
It's like the fans that are collectors. I guess I'm like, you know, kind of like the, I'm not like collecting like autographs or pictures. I'm collecting photons with my eye.
You're collecting memories.
Yeah, I'm collecting memories.
Like a replicant from Blade Runner.
I hold on to them and be like, I can't go senile and forget my experience seeing photons bounce off of William Shatner. It's okay if I can forget the face of the first girl I kissed, but I can never forget the Shatner photons.
Father, you've got a pretty good memory. I feel like you've got a solid shot. Have you ever seen any Discovery on like a larger, like on a movie screen or anything like that before?
I did on the Star Trek cruise 2 years ago, actually, season 4 in and of itself. One of the episodes came out while the cruise was going on in 2022, and they showed that it was episode 411, Rosetta. The third to last episode.
That big stuff in that.
But that will be fun seeing Disco in a theater experience Monday.
The show is really made for like big screen viewing, so I always feel like watching that show on the big screen in a theater is like it's what it's made for. It's a very cinematically filmed show. It doesn't like it's not generally shot like most television shows. It's very grand and operatic, and there's like a lot of big movements and like camera shots. So like it really lends itself to be this visually striking spectacle on the screen.
Yeah, and of all the Star Trek shows in this new modern era, you know, Alex Kurtzman has been very vocal about wanting, and it's obvious, it shows, but kind of each show to kind of have like its own lane, its own voice, and kind of almost reach out for a different audience. You know, like the diehard Trekkies are going to watch all of them, but as far as like penetration into the mainstream, they're kind of all taking different routes, you know? And Discovery is very much trying to embrace the big budget spectacle of the Kelvin movies. And Alex Kurtzman's talked about like how that's one of the goals of that show is to be able to do that type of stuff on television.
Yeah, I like the fact that it's just it feels very kinetic. There's always sort of this movement, and I think it helps in establishing sometimes some of the tension. And you kind of get a good sense. I think what they do really well visually is that a lot of the times you get a very good sense of what the surrounding is like. So you have an idea of like where everybody is and where the story is kind of taking itself. And just like everything visually, I feel like it helps with the cohesiveness of the story and the show.
I think that's a good point. It's as cinematic as TNG TV wasn't.
And that's one of the interesting things about season four, I think, is in season four, it did have a lot of big budget spectacle type stuff, but it was almost a bit more tame. They all, like some of it, you know, they almost try to take kind of a Kubrick approach, right? Like the big hot movie right now is Dune Part Two, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, but almost kind of like, no, this is going to be kind of like slow, serious sci-fi with these big, epic, grand shots of this heady science fiction concept of these new life forms and depicted so beautifully and cinematically, like something Kubrick would try to shoot in 2001. It was really trying to, you know, swing for that on occasion.
No, I think maybe all the budget just went to the Species 10C.
And the COVID restrictions. So
yeah.
Right.
That was another interesting thing about season four was shooting this during a pandemic and that struggle. So
I still can't imagine how tough that must have been to film, like just the logistics of setting up shots and or moving actors around in that.
Yeah, or then like someone would test positive for COVID and you have to like shut everything down for 24 hours or, you know, whatever the procedures were. But everyone talked a lot about how it was very hard. I mean, like they weren't like complaining. They were, you know, willing to do it to work safely. But it sounded like it was definitely a pain in the ass. You know, you're having to work so much harder to do like the same job you were doing a year or two earlier. You know, but just to recap, because it has been a while. 2022 is 2 years ago since Discovery was being released. But the season, it was after the burn after season three. So it was a few months after that, and basically you get to see Burnham and the Discovery crew trying to help redistribute dilithium, help the Federation, reach out to old voices, people that had been kind of out of contact, reconnecting. And a lot of it kind of paralleled, I think, you know, real life kind of dealing with the COVID pandemic, and then, you know, how do we come out of this? You know, when vaccines come out and then people start, coming back to work and stuff like that. And it felt like, how do we transition out of this kind of universal trauma that everyone experienced and learned to kind of, you know, reconnect and reestablish communities? And then you have, you know, the fallout with the DMA. It destroys Book's planet, Quajon. They have this mysterious threat. It's another galaxy-ending, major-level, high-stakes season. But the episodes that kind of follow that take a different approach than previous Star Trek Discovery, where it was a lot more, it was like slower paced, it was more talky, and it felt like a lot more confident. It was like, oh yeah, let's just have these people just talk about this weird sci-fi scientific problem and problem solve, or let's just have like, you know, a diplomatic debate with the Federation Council, and let's have another conflict between Stamets and Zora and stuff like that. It was a lot talkier of a season, but as all that goes on, you get, you know, the big conflict of basically Book and this new character Tarka, who they want to take the more hawkish approach to the Tin Sea and do a preemptive strike. Burnham wants to do the diplomatic thing, and then we get to see Book and Burnham at odds against each other, and then at the end when they go and confront the Tin Sea, and we learn, like, oh, it's, you know, communication is really hard, but, you know, that's why it's so important, and also other people's intentions while why they're doing things. If they're in, like, a disagreement with you, it's important to, you know, look at their motivations and why are they doing what they're doing, and it's going to be difficult, but finding that common ground when you can and not giving up on that. And it ends with, I guess, Book goes off to do community service, and Earth rejoins the Federation. So at the end of the season, what all we have, Navarre, the Vulcans, they're back in. Earth is back in. And they said the Tellarites never left, and the Andorians are in talks, you know, post-Emerald Chain. So I assume season 5 will open with, you know, kind of the founding members are all back. The Federation has been more or less restored. But yeah, that's where we are at the end of the season.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Do we want to dive in with some first thoughts or some general thoughts, Father?
Sure.
I think we should Captain Pike at you. We should dive in and get your general sense of the season.
Yeah, as is the guest, please go first and just let us know your general impressions on Discovery season 4.
For me, I think what I really felt this season is it's the kind of first contact story that we often see in Star Trek, but it's most of the time I feel like when we do a first contact story, it's usually like we're there at the sort of beginning, and then we don't really get this whole drawn out process of how does that first contact go, what happens before the first contact, the preparations for it, and then what happens in the aftermath of that. So I think it's interesting that this season was essentially kind of structured like a one episode of what usually would be a classic Star Trek episode, but then they stretched it out into an entire season where everything is this minute process of like trying to figure out the little pieces that goes along into a first contact story, rather than just, you know, usually it's the 45 minutes in and out and, you know, you fix this planet kind of thing. And here, you know, we have to sit with some of the consequences of what happens in a first contact, what happens if it goes wrong, all the different options that comes with, you know, dealing with different kinds of people. And I think what I really liked about this season is that it feels very, very pure Star Trek in the sense that it is this first contact story that is very much like the heart of Star Trek is how do you contact with other species in different worlds. And this one is just like, it's everything that is kind of Star Trek distilled down to a single story and a single season where you have these stories about connection and, you know, how do you come out of being disconnected and then put that together with the first contact of like, how do you communicate with people? How do you connect with other people? So I think what this season really does beautifully, and I think what Discovery has always done very beautifully, is tell stories about people and how do people connect to each other. And I think this show has always exhibited this very, very huge awareness of like this emotional intelligence that, you know, beyond just things about logic and science, you know, there's a very human part to life. And I think Discovery is very aware of that. And it's the kind of show that wears its heart on its sleeves, but it's proud to wear its heart on its sleeves. Mm-hmm. And it's not afraid of being vulnerable, not afraid of telling these stories where, you know, people are still trying to figure it out. You know, it's not perfect. There's a lot of things that go wrong all over the place. But then, you know, people are trying to figure this out. People want to learn, want to be curious, want to connect with each other. And I think that's the kind of story that, you know, we need in the world right now. And what we need with Star Trek, too, is just this story about hope and connection. And I think this season was really like the epitome of that classic Star Trek story.
Right on.
Yeah, that first contact concept is definitely in the DNA of Star Trek. And, you know, I was speaking of the relevance of kind of that, how it did kind of ring true to what was going on in the real world in 2022. That was a cool blending of those two things. And you're right, it is a first contact season instead of a First Contact episode. I almost wonder if this would have been a good season to move to the 10-episode format instead of the 13, because it did feel like a little stretched out for 13 episodes. But I'll agree with the comment we got in our live audience from Boat Rick that it was the most structured and coherent season of the show. And for me, that was the thing that was so apparent to me on rewatch. I liked this season a lot the first time back in 2022. I said it was my favorite season of Discovery of the all four seasons we've had released so far. But when I rewatched it all condensed just within like the last 5 days, I liked it a lot more. I still feel like it goes on like a little too long. I have my problems at like the same point. I'm good with the first half of the season, and then I love the mid-season finale they did, but to connect, which is when Book it runs off with Tarka, and we had like that mid-season cliffhanger. When it comes back in part two, and then we get the I don't know if I should call it the infamous all-in casino episode. Remember, like, Dave and I both, if I recall correctly, both, like, didn't really like that one. And then the pacing in, like, the second part of the season gets, like, a little over the place. We're like, I'll love one episode, and then the next episode, I'm like, oh, I don't know. But then, like, I'll love the next one. And it was, like, kind of, like, back and forth like that. So I felt like if they had condensed that, you know, maybe if that wasn't, like, a six-episode stretch, if that was only, like, three episodes, and they got rid of, like, some, like, you know, the padding, like, let's give Book and Tarka a side quest. They got to go help Haas find the cheater in his casino. You know, you're like, it felt like some of that side quest stuff. I don't want to call it filler because it was moving the larger plot along. It's like, oh, but we have to go get the stuff for our weapon. But it felt like padding. It felt like stuff to, you know, Paramount Plus has ordered 13 episodes, so we got to write 13 episodes. And it would have been a good season, I think, to switch to the 10 episode format like they're doing in season 5. However, that is kind of my only large criticism of the season. I have like some other like nitpicky stuff, but beyond like that little bit of like bloat in there, this really is like my favorite season of Disco, and a big part of that just comes from it having the confidence to, you know, let's slow down and just talk a little bit. Yeah, this is Star Trek after all. We can do that. We don't have to be like all flashy all the time. And I'm curious about, you know, season 5, where they are going, they've said they're going much more action adventure in season 5. So I wonder if we'll lose some of that stuff I really liked in season 4. What I'm hoping is that it'll blend together, like how you were talking about blending the classic First Contact idea along with a contemporary relevant story of reaching out to forming new connections and rebuilding communities. The way that they blended that, I would love to see if they could blend, I guess, the talkier, I think a bit more mature writing in season 4 of Disco with that action adventure stuff that Alex Kurtzman said they like to bring over from the Kelvin movies. But Dave, what about you? What was your take on Disco season 4?
So I'll preface this by saying, you know, I didn't rewatch the whole season. I watched the first episode. I read through some recaps, and I watched some recaps on YouTube and stuff. So I might contradict myself, but what I remember is I struggled a bit with it, but it came, first of all, it came right on the heels of the Burn season, which as a concept was, I think, kind of a low point of the series for me. I was never convinced that was a good idea, and I didn't like how they executed it. So in a way, they could only go up for me, and I thought it has a really cool premise to the season, which was that Burnham, who is this very kind of, I don't want to say she's fly by the seat of your pants, but she is kind of she'll do everything on her own. She takes all the weight on her shoulders, and she is, I think that the president assesses her, the Federation president, that childhood trauma has made her desperate, you know, almost in a traumatic way to save everyone. Like, and I thought that was a kind of a fair assessment of the character. But now she's put in a position where she has to kind of build a coalition to deal with the Tensi aliens with Renegade Book on the side. And I think that's a great idea to challenge what has been her kind of command style, which is fast and loose, and put her in a place where she's got to kind of sit in the room with the grown-ups and sometimes make them work out, because they're not always grown-ups either. And where I often kind of struggle with Discovery is execution. I felt like those talky scenes, the writing wasn't always there to make them kind of... talking scenes can be great, and they didn't always sing for me. I found myself... do you remember this, Fathery, that I kind of liked Tarka as a character more than sometimes? I was like, the Enterprise crew is the Disco crew is so supportive that I was almost like needing a little bit of a renegade type and like a scoundrel. And
post-Georgia, we were missing the arch. We need a little arch.
Yeah, and you know, he has a sympathetic backstory, but he's flawed. He's very imperfect, and, you know, arguably, I'm like, he was kind of doing all of this to... reconnect with a guy who was just like a super bro. We don't even know if he was like, if they had a romantic connection.
It seems
implied, but why would Disco of all the shows not show that?
But I mean, like, it shows them like laying in bed cuddling together. So
do they show that? Okay, I forgot that. But like,
they're like doing math together, like in prison. These two like prison inmates that are like laying in bed together cuddling.
Even now, I still like that. I think that's sweet, and that's why I ended up liking this guy's character, even though he was also despicable in a bunch of different ways. Yeah. And arrogant and all that stuff too. I thought the 10C was a very ended up being a very cool concept. I like that they brought in some old Trek lore, like the barrier at the edge of the galaxy and all of that stuff was cool. But there was one or two fundamental things. Like, I didn't quite buy that Book would, who's like, you know, this known for his empathy, would quite go as renegade as he did. There's a point where he says, Burnham says something like that. And he says, hey, when you first found me, you know, or when we first encountered each other, I was, what was he? He was doing something that was like some kind of outlaw thing to help
the transworms.
Yeah, a species that was on the verge of extinction. Yeah. And I was like, you know, that's still like, you're doing outlaw stuff for a very good cause. And this is a very vengeful cause. And it's just, I know, obviously he's had the Alderaan experience, but I just.
And he keeps having it. Like, it keeps
having it. What was the other one?
Because it keeps blowing up more and more planets.
Oh, right, so. Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. I guess I failed to be totally convinced by that. On the other hand, the actor killed it. Burnham did some great work. I remember when she thought he was dead. Man, that was such a good scene. But it was, in some ways for me, a standard Discovery season, which is to say I liked more than I didn't, but I struggled sometimes. So revisiting it, though, I was like, I was almost kind of reassessing it and like feeling like, man, I do want to rewatch the whole season. And I miss these characters. And I think that to some degree, if I can accept a little bit more, even in a talkier season like this, that this is an adventure series in a lot of ways. And even something like you'd mentioned, Father, like that casino sequence, I think I would enjoy it more knowing it was coming for one thing, but also knowing that this is like as much as the Kelvin movies, as Raiders of the Lost Ark, Pirates of the Caribbean and stuff like that. It's kind of driven sometimes by big melodrama and or just like interesting scenes. They sometimes swerve unexpectedly. And I think if I kind of embrace that a little bit, I will enjoy that stuff a lot more. Take the show as what it is.
I was surprised with Disco season 4 on rewatch that I liked it even more than I did the first time, because a lot of it is, you know, kind of like mystery unfolding stuff. And I don't think Discovery has a great track record with mysteries, with, you know, like the Red Angel reveal, and a lot of people were burned by the burn. But I see so much stuff in like the first episode of like, oh, they knew like the ending was going to be about like connection and communication. And it's like, oh, that actually, like, I can see the beginning and ending. There's like a coherent through line of the season, which I guess like you shouldn't get like a lot of props for that. I guess that should just be kind of like the norm, the expectation. But just like compared to some other seasons of Discovery, it felt like a lot more cohesive, as Boat Wreck was saying.
It absolutely was more cohesive, but I did not like that the aliens were essentially, they had oopsed some mining and that's what was causing it. I wanted something smarter than that.
That was the other thing that I really liked, was the inversion of Devil in the Dark, where, oh, our galaxy is the Horda.
And that's a very classic Star Trek thing, but they can show it on such a grand scale in Discovery. And honestly, that was very cool.
And the fact that there's no, the closest thing to a bad guy in the season is Tarka. Mm-hmm. But there's no Badmiral, there's no bad president.
And everybody expected it. Like, we were waiting for that to happen the same way we were waiting for
Vance.
We were kind of waiting, I think, for Vance to maybe be a Badmiral early on.
I hope he's in season 5. I haven't seen him in any of the trailers or anything, so I hope he's still around.
Interesting.
I haven't watched any. We have screeners for Disco, but I haven't watched anything yet because I'm waiting for the premiere. But speaking of Tarka, I don't know, Pika, what did you think of Tarka's inclusion in season 4?
I think with Tarka, I felt like he was an interesting character in the sense that I think in any story you do need some form of an antagonistic force. And I think, you know, just the DMA stuff on its own, it wouldn't have been very compelling or very interesting. because, you know, what's this big blob glowy thing gonna
do? Well, you know, he's like co-antagonist with Book. Yeah. He kind of is dragging, he's kind of dragging Book along a little
bit. Yeah, it's kind of like, I feel like it's like the angel of the devil, you know, whereas like on Book's shoulders, you know, Michael's on one side and then Tark is on the other. So it's this very interesting thing where I feel like having a character like Tarka really injects a lot of like tension and drama beyond just the fact that physically there is a huge threat, because then Tarka also creates a threat that's more internal, whereas, you know, it affects Michael and Book's relationship, it affects Book's relationship with the rest of the Discovery crew, and it essentially affects, you know, what the Federation, this very small rebuilding Federation, is trying to do. So like, I like the fact that this enemy is more of an internal thing, because the real threat that they're really dealing with is, how do we get people to get along? You know, it really wasn't this like big bad trying to, like, that's in the background, and I think that's what really works with this season. It's just that, like, yeah, there's a bad guy, yeah, there's this huge threat, you know, looming over everybody, but I think the bigger threat that's more active in the story is the fact that you have everybody at different places and different mindsets and different perspectives. So how do you get everybody into the same room to, you know, get along, really? And I think that struggle is much more interesting to watch because it's more relatable and it's more human. And it has, like, there's more tangibility to this threat, this enemy, that's more than just like a galaxy-ending threat that's going to come at the, you know, the end of the season to like come kill us all. But
more,
you know,
personal, yeah, it becomes more personal.
Yeah, it's more like affecting, because we see how it impacts our characters, the crew, and we see how it really impacts the rest of the universe. You know, in the way that it's not just like, oh, everybody's going to die, but it's more like, well, how is this universe going to really thrive if everybody is going to be isolated and disconnected from everybody and just not getting along? Because then that's not really going to be a good future for everybody to build towards.
By the way, in that sense, the burn as a plot works very well with our real world, because it did establish the disconnectiveness of everyone.
Yeah, and
they lucked out with that. They said, like, boy, oh boy, we had no way of predicting the COVID pandemic. But yeah, season three totally, like, works as an allegory.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's really interesting, because I think when season three came out, I feel almost like maybe it almost didn't feel like all the stuff with the burn. But I feel like, when you watch it nowadays, like, that season and the burn, like, that storyline feels like almost a little bit more like real and more like emotional, because we've kind of come through like our own sort of collective burn, so
we
to speak.
Did.
And so, like, that story, like, going into season four, it feels like it's almost like a connected story, like a logical consequence and next step that follows.
I feel like sometimes Discovery feels like it's, you know, and it sometimes is being pulled in different directions by different writers and producers and things. But it is kind of one big organic story. And, you know, you can see Michael Burnham's growth, and, you know, you can see the ship coming together. You can see Tilly changing over time, Saru changing over time. By the way, I love Saru being back. That was so good. I just always feel like he adds to the dynamic, even if he was a bit more of a background character. But yeah, it does feel like an organic whole, even if, you know, I might quibble with
more so here. Now more so after Michelle Paradise took over and they stopped the changing of the showrunners every 10 episodes.
for sure.
Yeah, no, I think that definitely, I think, helped steady the ship more, because I feel like there is this feel once season three came along that, like, there was more confidence. Not to say that I don't think the show was ever, like, not confident, because I do feel like the first two seasons, despite its problems, they were also very confident shows. Yeah. But it just felt like, I think, everybody had settled in, like, emotionally.
Like, they'd found themselves or their characters' arcs.
Yeah, it felt like there was less of, I guess, like, behind the scenes where, like, you know, things were shifting all over the place and they didn't really know who was, you know, like, the main showrunner, and, you know, all those things behind the scenes were changing so much. So I think it helped that the writer's room was settled, and it helped that, like, I guess the cast and crew must have felt settled in that sense, because they had done it a few more years. So, you have a showrunner that's there now from, you know, beginning to end. So everything just feels like, you know, okay, we got this, you know, we can kind of like, you know, put our foot down and really kind of go tell this story. So I feel like season three also, with season three and season four together, it just, it feels like a continual growth of that confidence, where they felt like, I think they didn't feel so beholden to, you know, the past, the canon, and all these expectations.
They could do their own world building.
Yeah,
yeah, they were in the 32nd century, yeah. So they literally had a new canvas yeah. to paint on.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's probably more freeing for them that, you know, they could just kind of do whatever they wanted. You know, it's like you suddenly have all these expectations and all this pressure that's sort of just lifted, because you're like, you're off in your own little place. You can kind of do what you want. You're destined, you're like, there's enough distance between you and the other stuff that, like, you can make your own path. And I think, you know, they just kind of trotted forward, and this story came out. And I think, you know, that's probably also, you know, maybe that contributes to part of that, like, emotional intelligence and part of that, like, connection. Because I imagine that crew and that the cast and the writers and everything, like, with everything they've gone through, like, they must have, like, they probably felt like the Disco Group itself.
Sort of trauma bonded and all the rest, yeah.
Speaking on, like, the recurring theme of connection, if I can just circle back to Ruan Tarka again for a little bit, but... That was one of the unique things about his brand of, I don't even know if I want to call it villainy, but let's say his brand of antagonism, was that it was still motivated by connection, but also a bit of disconnection. All of his, like, you know, human connection, all of us as social animals, we you know, we need to be connected to be like a healthy, functional human, at least on some level. Yeah, I know he's Risian and not human, but, you know, like Kirk told Spock, you know, in Star Trek, everyone's human. It's a show about humanity. It's Gene Roddenberry is telling us stories about humankind. So Tarka has all of his connection focused on one individual, and because of that central focus, he's incredibly selfish. You know, he doesn't care about, like, the rest of the universe. There's even, like, when Book is telling him, like, this is going to, even you going to this universe is still going to endanger Earth, and he's like, well, not for a few months, you know, there's a lot of bright scientists, they'll figure, I would be able to figure it out, you know, if I was sticking around, some guy will figure it out, you know, someone else's problem. He doesn't care, but he still has, like, that connection. But it's like, even if you are, like, a really loving person, you can still be, you know, pretty terrible.
I'm trying to think, Father, did they show before he got kidnapped by the like imprisoned by Emerald Chain, right?
Yeah,
for years, was he still kind of that ego? He was still that same egocentric guy, right?
They never show his, like, pre-captivity, but I assume just being from Ryza and being, like, a guy who's just, like, all you care about is just, you know, the science and being, like, the smartest dude in the room, being the genius that Elon Musk tries to pay everyone to pretend that he is. If that's, like, your only concern, and you live on, like, you know, the vacation planet Ryza, you're probably, I just picture him as being, you know, really, like, stuck up and thinking, like,
resentful.
Everyone else is an idiot. And
yeah.
Well, I think he's kind of like a early season Stamets in a way.
Yeah.
You know? That very kind of standoffish, you know, seemingly arrogant. So I imagine that, like, Tarka is probably like that as well. And then he kind of found this one person that he really connected with. You know, they have the same, like, the intelligence. They kind of speak the same language, basically.
Right.
And then afterwards, unfortunately, he did not get the healing that he needed. And he kind of became, like, I guess I'd say a much more toxic version of the, you know, the egotist he was before. You know, his love for this guy turned to something really, really dangerous for everybody else. I think, you know, if there's a message there, it's that anything can turn toxic if it's not kind of managed, if it's not thoughtful. And, you know, he didn't seem to connect with other people to have that ability to grow.
Yeah, I think you can't stay in isolation, but you also can't just, you know, reach out to this one thing, this one other person, and just say, you know, to hell with the rest of the universe. That's...
Maybe he needed to see Guinan. He needed to just talk to Guinan for a few minutes. She'd have dropped a wisdom bomb on him.
Or Vic Fontaine, or, you know, one of our Star Trek counselors over the years.
Hey, Pally, what's wrong? Why the long face?
There's a lot of therapy. There's a lot of, like, therapy in Disco Season. Even though, like, you know, we've had shows with, like, therapists on them before, but I don't know. This is probably, like, the most, like, therapy-focused season of Star Trek, I think.
I think maybe they just figured everybody needed therapy after COVID. They were just like, yeah, no, inject the therapy into the show.
As a thematic for Discovery, I think it's actually one of their strongest broad season, show running, you know, from beginning to end sort of thematics is that the characters kind of all are kind of ultimately there to support each other when they need to get some kind of therapeutic, follow through or release. And I like that. I believe is this the first season where Culber really fell into that role, which I like.
He started doing that a little bit in season three, but out of the gates in season four, everyone is like where Michelle Paradise wanted them. You know, Burnham's in the captain's chair, Culber's on the therapy couch, right on the chair next to the therapy couch. I guess people are like where she wanted them, and I think that made a big difference. Because I love Hugh Culber, therapist. I mean, he was fun as like a Star Trek doctor, but I think he adds more to the show. We get these fun, intimate scenes with Wilson Cruz, and you know but great moments between him and Anthony Rapp. There were some great moments between him and Doug Jones. There were some great moments between him and David Ajala. So and that's a cool thing. Yeah, everyone's talking to the therapist, and even like the therapist has to go to Kovich for therapy. He's like, you know, I give all this empathy to people like all day, and Kovich comes in to be like, here, I'm here to give support to you.
Kovich and Stamets.
You got to take care of yourself too.
Stamets also was there for him.
Yeah, yeah, and that was another good thing. The show has a an objective that is representation, which kind of Star Trek's always, you know, famously done. The original series famously did, and that's one of the Michelle Paradise has talked about. It's important to her to show the a good, healthy queer relationship between Stamets and Culber, and also the queer found family with Adira and
Gray.
And Gray, now that Gray has like a physical body and gets, and that whole thing of like being seen and like getting the allegory with, I don't know, a lot of that stuff is like really cool. I'm all happy now because I think about I see a lot of young gender queer Star Trek fans that like really connect to Discovery. And I think, you know, in the future, kind of like how now there's like this big like Janeway army, like all these largely women, but people that, you know, were obsessed over Voyager in the 90s, and then you see so many of them now. I'm already starting to, you know, kind of see that same process with Discovery.
You know, I feel like Discovery, like Trek has always tried to be progressive, but in the particular instance of, I guess I'd say the queer community, it feels like the best ally Trek has ever had, just bar none.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's, I think what I like about it the most is that it feels just like, it feels like the relationships are just the same as anyone else. You know, it's like, it's not something that's done in a certain way where it's like a stereotypical thing. It's just like, it's a relationship, you know?
It's not a very special episode either.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, it's not like your after school special episode that discusses this issue. It's just like, it's there with the characters. It's there in their stories. It's there in some of the issues that they deal with, but like, they're not just like the gay character or like the non-binary character. It's like, yeah, that's part of who they are, but like, it's not this entire thing that like takes over their identity. You know, it's like you look at these characters and you look at their relationships. It doesn't feel like any of those characters solely exist to be this one thing. You know, they're like very multifaceted. They're like different layers.
Yeah.
And they have like different relationships with different characters. And I think that's one of the things that like, it's not just, oh, we have the gay couple and they're just gonna be, that's all them, they'll always just be around each other. And like, that's their little orbit.
I remember our friend Jesse Gender, a great YouTuber, commented on her season four video a couple years ago, but she commented on like the intersectionality in season four, but you do get a lot of that, like these people that are part of like multiple communities, just like having you know, Culber as a gay man, but also as an Afro-Latino man, for example, and he has scenes with other black characters like Burnham and Book, but then he has scenes with other queer characters like Adira and Gray, and you really like that sense of intersectionality existing in the future, and yeah, like the thing I was just commenting, you know, it is kind of silly of like, oh, the invisible boyfriend, we will build you a body so you're not invisible anymore, you'll be seen, but you know, like. Yeah, sometimes you gotta have like a little bonk bonk on the head and be like,
"Trek is right, not the." did you just drop a Miri reference in there?
I did.
Nice, that's good stuff.
Well, Mission Logs does that. They used to. The Star Trek podcast Mission Logs. They would refer to that as a bonk bonk on the head type thing.
I mean, yes, yeah, so
Trek is not certainly above it. That's part of, yeah. In some ways, you said hard, Pikachu, you said hard on your sleeve. That is Discovery. And, you know, I'll confess every once in a while they do something that makes me a little, not cringe in the sense of like they shouldn't, you know, like, oh, that, you know, you're, it's too trying too hard or whatever, but just maybe a little, like, it's that weird thing where that's why I kind of liked, I guess, Tarka as much as I did is, because although the crew is flawed, they're very supportive of each other, and like mm-hmm. I wanted to see somebody who fell. And
you need someone, you need someone who doesn't get along, who doesn't like want to hug everyone every 10 minutes. So Giorgio was that in season 3, and then Tarka can be that in season 4.
Yeah.
Well, I do think that, like, in a sense, maybe in a more subtle way, I feel like Jet Reno is kind of that character.
Yeah.
Like, but she's there.
One of the sad things of season 4, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but she had a reduced role because of COVID.
Yeah.
She had to avoid a lot of filming as a cancer survivor, a immunocompromised person. She was even more limited in what she could contribute to the season.
I think there was that really cute scene with Reno and Adira, where they're like talking about like Detmer is like so confident and like she's got this all figured out, and then like Reno's kind of like trying to help her figure out, like, you know, like, how do you talk to, like, just go make friends, and, you know, like,
yeah,
how to gain that confidence and like how to figure yourself out. So I just like, I like the fact that we Disco does have this like kind of really cool and varied background cast. Mm-hmm. That kind of weaves in and out of the stories, because it's really interesting to see them kind of pop in and out and interacting with all these different characters and like the different kind of like perspectives that they provide and in like little different ways where, like, you know, these characters like Vance, like Rilik, like Tarina, and like Reno. It's just like, it's really fascinating to watch this group of characters that like have these different interactions with each other. And then you have like, you know, Saru and Tarina has this lovely, lovely romance. But then you also have Tarina have scenes with Book that are dealing with his grief. And I just like, it's really interesting the way that like this show puts diverse characters in scenes together that like you wouldn't really expect it to really work. But they somehow make it work. And then, you know, something like Book and Stamets, you know, in that one episode where they're together on the ship figuring things out. And then, you know, Stamets is like, well, I don't know how to talk to this guy. You know, like, how does that communicate?
I didn't revisit that one. I want to see that one. I remember liking that unusual pairing.
Yeah. I caught that one on the cruise ship a few days ago on the Star Trek cruise, actually. That was one that I watched on there.
That one's really funny. It's just like, it's such an odd pairing. And the like, she's like, Book is so empathetic, but then he's also at that point where he's kind of had his guard up and everything. So you're like, you've got Stamets, who's usually the guy with his guard up, and then now he's like trying to like awkwardly connect and be like really supportive, but like he's like, I don't know how to really do that. So it's really funny to like just watch that interaction, and then having them having that awkwardness about like, well, you know, they're both now like piloting the Spore Drive and kind of having that little bit of jealousy in there.
But that kind of they kind of bond over, yeah, you know, Spore Drive, and that was something in season 3. The two of them never had a scene together. And I love that Michelle Paradise's approach to that in the writer's room was like, you know, these two characters, they don't have much in common. They've never had a scene together. I'm gonna just create a relationship between the two of them. I look at that and I see a storytelling opportunity. I really like that approach. It does kind of speak to, I think her objectives tend to be more about the character writing than like the bigger plot stuff. But when you have the fully realized characters, when you have these personalities fleshed out and you have enough material there that an actor knows what to do, and that character seems like a real person to the audience, those scenes kind of just like write themselves, you know. But like Jet Reno and Adira having a conversation about making friends, like, you can just kind of just like just picture, like, oh yeah, I can picture like Adira having a lot of trouble with that, and I can picture how Jet Reno would come in and kind of be like mom and coach her through it and you know, kind of give her a little bit of shit along along the way, but you know, you hear those voices in your head, and that's something like not all TV shows establish that, but that's something that Discovery has. The characters, I think, have that level of realization.
Yeah, they feel like people, you know, like they feel like people that you'd meet, people that you'd have like conversations with. It's just like I always felt like it's really interesting that like each of those characters are such distinct personalities that, you know, I feel like it makes the conversation in the room a lot easier, I'd imagine, in some ways, because this character's got their own way of dealing with things, but then this character has this specific way of dealing with things. So it's like when you put them in a room, you can kind of figure out, you know, where their little path are going to cross, where they're going to hit, where they're going to like go the same way.
So right. They've been defined well enough that I don't want to say they write themselves. Obviously a writer does a lot of work, but yes, to some degree, the ideas at least, I think, come forth pretty easily, I suspect.
Yeah. I should say, sorry, I just have to like add some context to the statement I just made, but I'm talking more about, I guess, like the principal cast. I do think some of the background people still feel very, very background, like I guess Detmer and Owo, I feel like they have some personality. Bryce and Reese, I mean, like they give them scenes to like do things and contribute, but those moments they do kind of stand out of like, oh wait a minute, Bryce is going to come over here and talk about surfing just because we want to give the actor some dialogue. Like I kind of wish they'd be incorporated a little bit more like organically.
Yeah, I think that's probably the, if there was one sort of, I guess, advice or improvement I would give to the show is that I think they're trying a little too hard to like push some of the background characters forward, probably because there's always this endless complaining about like, oh, we don't really know the bridge crew. We don't really know them. But I've always been, you've probably seen me say this on Twitter a million times already, but like I've always been of the mind that like Discovery has its main characters. It has its main recurring characters. Those are the stories that they chose to focus on. So the fact that the background bridge crew don't really have like huge personalities, I'm okay with that because that's what they're there for. They're the background, they're the steady background support, and that's what they serve in the story. And I think the show was in a way maybe listening a bit too much into that criticism so that they tried to tack on a bit more than it needed to be there. Because there are scenes where these characters just sort of interact and they're very natural. Mm-hmm. And they do like give character like personality. But I think when they try to push for more, it often feels like it's coming at the expense of like time that could be spent elsewhere.
How did you feel about Owo's sort of spotlight on that, whatever that casino episode was?
Yeah, All In.
No,
is
like,
that one of those cases?
Actually, I think that's a case where I didn't have a problem with that because I think that narrative of her being like, you know, a good fighter stuff served that plot in the story. So I think in that episode, I felt like it was okay. I think what my main issue is just there's some scenes where they tacked on where it's just expositional dialogue, where it's literally just the actor stood there to deliver my backstory. This is why I am this way. And then you're just kind of like, well, that just feels really weird. Like that's not, it doesn't feel natural. You know, like when Owo's in that fighting ring in that, you know, in that casino episode, I felt like that was more natural because it had a relationship to the plot. She was doing stuff. So it wasn't just like she stood there and then delivered like, you know, a paragraph of her backstory, you know?
Right.
But like, for example, I think, you know, which episode was that? I think it was the episode where they were saving the prisoners. And I think Bryce was there. And they literally, it was just that, like, there was a 10-second scene of him just delivering dialogue that I was like, you couldn't have, like, set this somewhere else.
Yeah, it's like Rice, thanks for helping out. And he's just like, oh, of course. One time when I was a little kid, you know, my family was helped out from a hurricane. So I'm happy to help here. And like, that's it. This is like, okay, like, because people on the internet were like, why doesn't the tactical officer ever do anything? So it's like, okay, let's give them something to do here. But,
right, like, Bryce, hurricane, got it.
Yeah, it's like, it feels like they've stopped the episode to be like, hey, these characters are people. And you're like, you don't really need to do that. Because I actually think like what they usually do, which is occasionally showing them interacting and showing them like saying different things and or like, you know, thinking up different ideas. I think that's personality enough. Like that builds little by little the characters of who they are. And like they have personalities. They're just not hugely big personalities like our main characters, which, you know, them as like secondary slash tertiary background support characters, that's more than enough. And so I feel like, you know, if I would ever tell something to the writer's room, I would just say, relax on that whole, oh, the background group isn't getting enough screen time critique, because they get enough as it is to the role that they're supposed to be in. And I think when you're like stopping the show to an entire halt just to deliver like a 15 second expositional dialogue, I think that does a more of a disservice to the show and the characters than them just not doing anything at all.
I really like that episode, though, the examples that you mentioned with
the
prisoners.
That felt like a classic sort of TOS, TNG kind of episode.
Yeah, and it also was had some relevance to real life, because the leaving the prisoners behind to die in the explosion caused by the DMA, that was not dissimilar to how people in the American criminal justice system were treated during the COVID pandemic. So that... Right. That rang true, and it had a really cool guest star performance from the actor Michael Gray Eyes, who played the convict Felix.
Yeah, he got some good stuff to work with in that one, I remember.
And it ties into, like, I didn't realize this during the original run, of course, but the whole thing of, like, well, people's motivations matter and the reasons matter. And then when Michael has to learn that with the murder nun Javini, with their co-op Malat stuff, which I like the co-op Malat, I like them using them. I had some problems with that episode that I talked about at the time. They kind of, like, now in retrospect don't seem, like, as bad, but that idea of the reasons matter. If someone is committing a crime, if someone is doing something harmful, it's important to ask, well, what was their motivation? Maybe they have like a good reason to do a bad thing? Not that that's always going to excuse it, but it's definitely important context. You know, right. Season one, context is for kings, right? So it all ties back together.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing in law, you know, intent does matter. You know, what is your intention? Like, what were you trying to do? You know, it's like that context is very important in how we judge something that's done by someone, because, you know, an act in itself could be a good or a bad thing, but what people do it for and the reasons that they're doing it, I think, are the more nuanced and important part, rather than specifically just solely the act of itself.
It's the whole kickoff point for Les Miserables.
Oh, the other cool thing about that episode...
bread.
That episode, the example. Oh yeah, we're gonna get like Eddington and Sisko now and talk about Les Mis. But no, the other cool thing I liked in the examples is that they brought back they call it the Akali, that species from Enterprise, Civilization, season one, episode 9 or 10, I believe. But you know, they're kind of like Renaissance era people during Enterprise in the 22nd century. But you go 1,000 years later to the 32nd century, and they're part of the interstellar community, and they have like a space colony. And I was like, okay, that made sense. It is like 1,000 years later. So, you know, they'd be like, you know, if Earth went from the 14th century to the 24th century, you know? So, that was fun to see. That was more of Discovery doing like really good world building in their 32nd century, and they did much better. I was nervous. I was so nervous when they went to the 32nd century, because I was like, oh, they think this is going to like free them from canon, but like, how are they going to have like technology that's like more advanced than everything we've seen before? Like, how are they going to do a lot of this stuff? And what they've actually done, how they handled the 32nd century, I think the burn, even if you don't like the reveal of it, just kind of having that, the Federation being taken down a peg or two, and mm-hmm. Discovery kind of, not, it's not full on post-apocalyptic, but it's post, post-catastrophe, you know, it wasn't an apocalypse, but it was a catastrophe for sure. And being a part of like the rebuilding of that. And I, as a TOS fan, I like that part of the Star Trek canon is like took some of that 23rd century, that 23rd, you know, Kirk and Spock attitude of rolling up your sleeves and getting shit done. They needed some of that in the 32nd century.
It's rare that you're going to have, like, as any historical trend, a just upward, everything better and better and better and better and better forever. There, something will come along, you know, some resource drain, some sort of war, something like that will cause some sort of catastrophic effect like that. And so, yeah, I think Discovery deserves credit for creating a structure for the far-flung future that they can play with, mm-hmm. that has some big dramatic events. I think programmable matter and the personal transporters and some of the other stuff they've done. All
Tricom
felt like,
badges.
Yeah, they were within our conceptual range. It wasn't like, you know, we're going to shrink down to atoms and move the matter around ourselves. Like, it wasn't, like, just completely wild.
Yeah, they don't like, turn into Q, but they're...
It's, right, it still looks like Star Trek. It's just that sometimes the nacelles don't connect to the ships.
The only time it kind of stood out and distracted to me, it's like, okay, the 32nd century phasers should be, like, pretty powerful. When they're fighting, like, when the cadets are fighting the monster in the snow with Tilly, I'm like, okay, a 23rd century phaser could do some badass shit. Your 32nd century phaser, you'd think would be able to, like, take down a moon or something, you know?
Well, maybe they just don't want to hand that to children, you know?
The cadets get the nerfed version. I like
right,
that.
Were they on a mission, like, that was,
yeah, they
meant
were doing,
to be just,
yeah.
Just a
they,
training
They were
mission.
Doing the proof of concept for the Starfleet Academy yeah. show. Just like, I think that Disco 202, the Church Planet episode, New Eden, I'm convinced that was Akiva Goldsman doing a proof of concept for Strange New Worlds.
Yeah. It's yeah. It's interesting what you guys mentioned about the technology. I think one of the things I really love about the way that they've like utilized 32nd century technology is that it works so well in a lot of the action scenes, mm-hmm. like especially just like them like having that like personal transporter thing where they just kind of yeah. bounce around all over the place, and then they like utilize it in like various action sequences. And then, like, with the ships as well, it feels like they understood that they didn't just create these new techs to be like, oh, look, fancy new tech. But, like, they understood how it works within the universe, you know.
Like, how it would integrate in every moment of their lives, not
yeah,
just
exactly.
one
so,
or
like,
two showpiece scenes.
If, yeah, exactly. If this is the show for your flashy Kelvin spectacle action... It makes sense. You would do that in your 32nd century, where you could get the most bonkers with the tech.
Yeah,
it would make the most
it's
sense.
It's really
you know?
Interesting because, like, I'll watch some scenes where like they're utilizing the like various different 32nd technology, and I'm just like, it's so well integrated into the action scenes that like you have to think that like they have to have like that concept in their minds to be like, okay, so we get this thing, we do this, and then they go that way, and then they go over here. So it's just like it's really interesting to see like. There is care put into even just the minute like action bit that utilizes like in universe technology that it's like they're not just mindlessly thinking like, oh, let's make a cool action scene, but like let's make a cool action scene that utilizes the tech that we have in the story that actually, you know, works and it makes sense and it makes sense to the characters. So I think it's really nice. I mean, speaking of season 5, but just like that one little sneak peek scene that we got from it, I was also just like, oh, that's good usage of like 32nd century
That's
tech.
What I thought. I thought that the tech was neat. Dave pointed out the action-y bits a little, like Burnham is kind of, you know, flip it and kind of like, it almost kind of seems like she's not taking the stuff seriously. Like, I don't know if she should be that casual about like flying through war, but I love that the technology allows characters to do that type of stuff and that they can show it to us.
As I was rewatching the first episode, a place where I thought they were a little too Kelvin, too cavalier in their, like, it's like they know they're not going to get hurt sometimes, was when they twice jumped off a cliff into Book's ship, and it formed up around them, like, in, like, the first 10 minutes. And I was like, that might be a bit much.
Well, the little guy was, like, the escape... That was not his ship, that was the little guy. So I think that was kind of the planned escape thing. But the reason why I like that scene is because the first time I watched that, I remember like being annoyed. I was like, why can't the butterfly people hit them? Why are they shooting like Star Wars stormtroopers, you know? And then Michael says like, wait a minute, they should be able to hit us. And I was like, oh, this is kind of like smart Kelvin is what I referred to it as, so...
Yeah,
I liked that in the moment, and I also really liked that episode because it made me like root for like the .23 robots, which I complain about those when they're in seasons 1 and 2 of Disco. I don't like Starfleet robots, but I'm fine with them in the 32nd century. They don't bother me. I cheer for them when they take like the dilithium to the butterfly people satellite. I'm like, go .23s, go! I'm cheering for you. So.
I'm always pro dot. The dots. I think when they were introduced in Discovery, I was like. They made this for me. Like, I have been waiting for the dots.
Like, did you want some, like, I don't want to say just Star Wars if it has droids, but, like, droids type things?
No, I just wanted something cute in Starfleet like, very, like, it's very friend-shaped. You know, it's very round.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very Wall-E, and I felt like the Starfleet, of all places, should have multiple, like, Wall-E, like, Eve-shaped friendly creatures just to send out, because why not?
I want to ask before we sign off, we should talk about like what our favorite things and least favorite things of the season were real quick. But before that, I just want to ask on the dot 23s, how do you feel when the one dies screaming in agony and in stormy weather?
That was upsetting.
It's kind of disturbing.
Like, can y'all quick contextualize it for me, because I forget what happened.
They just kind of send one out as like a probe, and it gets like destroyed by the DMA radiation. But like as it's being like ate up, it like makes like a robot screech.
Oh no! Oh no!
Yeah, and then, so I was like, no, that's very upsetting. I would like my D23s to be very happy and very safe, you know. And so yeah, that was slightly terrifying, but at the same time, you know, as somebody who often yells about the way that Starfleet is not very good about safety and causes a lot of hazards.
Yeah, you're known on Star Trek Twitter as the Starfleet OSHA person.
Yeah. So I feel like as someone who worries a lot about their safety, at least they just sent out the dot and not a person.
And not a red shirt.
Well, yeah.
If you didn't like the dot 23 death screech, what would be a favorite moment, favorite episode, a high point in the season for you?
I think my favorite storyline of the season is actually Zora. I think Zora is possibly one of the most interesting characters that I think in all of Star Trek, really, because it's. You know, we've always sort of had this, like, oh, the ships are a part of this crew, the ship's part of the family, you know, it's like the ship is a home, and it feels like a person, but here it's like they've actually personified the ship. Mm-hmm. Zora is her own identity, she is the ship, and so it's really interesting to see that this crew that's very focused on family and connection, has kind of brought in this like new little life form that, you know, has built itself around wanting to protect her crew, her family. And so that the little story of like, oh, Zora's developing emotions, and the back and forth of like, well, is she a danger? Like, does she, what happens if her emotions comes to affect the decisions that needs to be made? And I think my favorite episode is probably the episode where we have that like back and forth debate with like Stamets and Kovich and the mm-hmm. rest of them.
But to connect, yeah.
Yeah,
that was my favorite, yeah.
Yeah, I really think the concept of Zora is so uniquely beautiful. And just the whole story about like, this is her identity, you know, like she is a part of this ship, part of this family. She is a person. And I think there was this one line that I really loved where in the middle of that argument, you know, Stamets is like, well, what if, you know, we need protection from her? You know, like she's already disobeyed the captain's orders once, you know, like what's to stop her from doing that? Like having the failsafe to terminate her, you know, it is our protection. And then I think Colbert says this line, I wrote it down, he says this line where I think he talks about how we can't hold a sentient being's life in our hands for our benefit. And I think like that is such an important thing, like the theme. And it links to like the classic Trek stories of, you know, Data's android, his identity and his sentience and his autonomy and stuff like that, where it's like, yeah, you can't just like, sure, you know, like Saru says, well, I could just, you know, hurt the crew and do something wrong. And then Stamets is like, well, you know, we can discipline you. And Colbert points out, yeah, discipline, not kill. You know, you discipline people if they've done something wrong. This failsafe would terminate her as a person, as a sentient, not a person, but like as a sentient being. And so like, The very distinct argument, I felt that story was like, it was very mature, like a very mature discussion about people's identities. You know, it also worked as an allegory, obviously, for a lot of, you know, the gender identity things, and all these other issues for many, like, different minority groups. But, like, just the whole general concept of like, well, yeah, Zora is Zora. And just because somebody fears that she might do something wrong doesn't give them the right to hold basically a gun to her head and say, oh, if you did it wrong, we're just going to kill you. You know, like that's not right. And I think it's it's very important that they had that conversation. And I think it's even more important that at the end, when Stamets is talking to Kovic about, like, you know, what would have happened if I hadn't, you know, agreed that, you know, Zora is okay, you know, like, would you have, like, taken her off the ship? And he says, I would have taken you off the ship.
Right, yeah.
And I think that is, like, a key part in, like, that's why that story works so well. It's that the show understood that the problem isn't Zora, that the problem in that story was actually how Stamets was behaving and his contentiousness towards Zora's identity as a person. So it's like, instead of, you know, blaming the minority and the marginalized people, you're saying, no, the problem is the person that is being oppressive, not the person who is being oppressed. And I think, you know, in so many stories nowadays, you always have this, like, oh no, everybody has to hold hands and get along, you know,
right,
middle ground, the concept, and it's like power imbalance thing. But it was just really, like, so powerful, I feel like, that Discovery understood this very core concept that, like, no, Zora hasn't done anything wrong. She's not the problem. The problem is how Stamets is behaving towards her. And that's the real problem. And that if this had continued, he would have been removed from the ship and not her. But, like, she's not being punished for just being who she is.
I love your framing of that, because it's another good point. I think it was important for the season to be a story about, like, that communication, even when communicating is hard and people don't agree with you and don't see things the same way as you, and it's going to be, you know, really hard to find common ground with them. But it is a bit more nuanced than just be like, well, the truth is in the middle. You know, maybe if we oppress the minority just a little bit or so, you know, it's like, no, it's a more nuanced, more complicated situation than that. And while I don't think it was a perfect season of television, I respect the hell out of it for tackling that, because that's, you know, and that's typically not the most common thing to do in Star Trek. A lot of times they do kind of take, like, the easy way, like, oh, look, we found a convenient, you know, third option. So we don't have to deal with the complexities of this. It is bold to not do that.
Yeah, I think I think what I really loved about it is the fact that, like, this story, not just Zora's story, but, like, just this whole season as a whole has this understanding about accountability. Whereas, mm-hmm. like, yes, maybe you didn't intend to do something wrong. Maybe you had good reasons to do something that, you know, hurt other people, but you still have to account yourself for the things that you do. And I think, you know, it's there at the end of the season with the 10C having to be accountable for the damage that they caused. But it's also Book having his own accountability for, you know, putting other people in danger, even though he obviously thought at the time, you know, that, like, he needed to do these things.
And accountability for Javini as well. She's held to it. That's another recruit. Yeah, see, like, this is, like, none of the... I've enjoyed every season of Discovery, but seasons 1 to 3, it's a lot harder to, you know, talk about and be like, oh, look, yeah, it was a consistent theme throughout the entire season, you know? So, I'm really happy for Michelle Paradise of being able to, like, oh, actually, like, let's let one showrunner tell a story. You know, imagine that.
It feels like Discovery, more than any other Trek, is kind of changing the face of what we would expect from, like, a bridge crew. And Zora as a concept is something that would usually be explored for, like, an episode or two in another Trek. Mm-hmm. But here they're like, we're going to engage with it and we're going to integrate her into the crew as surely as anything else. Because if we're really going to be about embracing new ideas, then we're going to kind of push what you can think Trek can be, which has always had a little bit more structured, you know, came out of a sort of military structure, even if they were science military. It's fascinating to see Discovery pushing the boundaries of what Trek can be.
And then on that same note, it is kind of an evolution of, you know, how do we keep telling the AI our people too stories? And it's like, well, okay, in the 24th century, we figured out we're okay with Data having the super advanced, super smart computer brain and, like, the body of a robot man. Now, if you have, like, a spore jumping ship and you're telling it to take you to these coordinates and it's telling you no and stuff, it's like, oh, well, how do you feel about AI sentience then? And are you going to be consistent with your morals and your conclusions, you know? And I thought that was you kind of needed to do something, like, weird, like Zora, but that's the Discovery weirdness. Like, Discovery's not afraid to get weird. It's not afraid to be like, oh, we're gonna have ghost boyfriend with a worm and belly partner. But
Dr. Crusher knows something about ghost boyfriends, okay?
We're gonna have tardigrade spore jumping, you know? We're gonna have Zora the computer who likes Buster Keaton movies, you know? Like, why not? It gets
weird.
It's
sometimes, you know, we say Discovery is this like kind of different, distinct entity of like the bold Star Trek. But like when you think about it, down to its core, it's also just very classic Star Trek. Because classic Star Trek is just all these weird, wild, like completely wacky concepts that TOS had that just like they do one episode and then it's like, well, whatever happened to that planet with all the weird Greek gods, you know? Like it's like the classic TOS was all just like filled with like wacky weird stuff, and I love that like Discovery is not afraid to just kind of like jump in with like all hands and feet into like the weird wacky unknown and just be like, you know what, maybe this isn't going to work out as like a story.
Yeah, I need some weirdness in my Star Trek. I need Sulu to be gardening a plant that's clearly like a glove in a hand, but it's still weird and looks fun on screen. I need to see Alice chasing the white rabbit on shore leave. I need that weird stuff. I need the animated series. I need them to go hang out with the devil in the center of the galaxy. I like that. So I'm all for having some weird in Trek.
If you don't push forward the bar on that and continually kind of imagine new things, then the weirdness, then you're just trying to like recreate the weirdness of either the 60s or 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially just a brand, or, you know, yeah. It's just like that you're, it's just an exterior coating, and it's not really, it's not pushing anything anymore. And so, but here, people, yes, butterflies did form wings on people.
Dave, did you have any high points you wanna point out? Any favorite moments?
You know, we've talked about a lot of them, and I think that the whole thing with like the kind of the hard work of figuring out the language of Ten-C, the hydrocarbons, and all that stuff, I thought that was some neat science fiction in there. You mentioned the episode. What was the one with the prisoners again?
The examples,
and I remember really liking that. I watched some scenes from it again, and I was like, "Yes, this was a standout kind of classic episode." Mm-hmm. I jotted down something. This was just when I was liking seeing Saru back in that first episode, and he said there was a nice bit of writing when he's talking to. Actually, I don't remember who he was talking to when he says this. He says, "If loss has taught us anything, it's that each of us must sit with pain in our own way." And I liked that. It's so Saru, right? It's when Doug Jones says it, you know, he's so filled with kind of that kind of paternal warmth and everything. That you know, it's really
I love
very
paternal
lovely.
Saru. He has a great scene with Tilly. We didn't talk much about Tilly, but
she was
had a reduced
a little bit
role
in the background.
She had a reduced role, yeah. I mean, there's like a lot of episodes she wasn't in. But they bring her back for a good moment in the last episode with Admiral Vance. You know, we needed to be concerned about Earth. We needed to have like Vance and Tilly there, you know, them putting like their asses on the line to save people. And then like, oh no, if our heroes don't fix this, they're going to die. So I'm invested because I like Tilly and Vance. And
well, it's also, I feel like with Discovery, it's one of those shows where you're like, you could believe that they could kill somebody off. You know, it could happen.
Yeah, like I didn't think that Book was really gonna be dead, but I couldn't like breathe easy until they brought him back. And you know, and part of that was Sonequa sold it. When I saw Sonequa Martin Green break down, it's just like she has such like a great actor face. When I watch Discovery and I see her smile, it makes me smile. If I see her cry, it makes me cry. Yeah. It's like she just has like a very like a expressive face that just like I'm not like a very like empathic person. I don't like pick up on feelings all the time. So it's just like, just for whatever reason, I always whatever she's trying to beam to me always comes like loud and clear, and I feel it too.
How about you, Fathery? What any other scenes you wanted to mention or moments?
I guess the only thing we haven't brought up, I think, would be All Is Possible. That's the cadet episode. I liked it more. I do kind of think the phasers should have been more heavy duty, but it makes me more excited about the Academy show now. I think having a show like set on Earth, I hope it's like Earth-based, because I mean, Picard plays around on Earth a lot, but I think that might just be fun. Just like, let's just explore like this new 32nd century Earth, and you know, I'm sure there's still gonna be, you know, field trips to other planets all the time, so.
Earth had some issues, so Earth could be an interesting place.
Right, but you know, they're rejoining the Federation, so Earth is trying to improve too, and mm-hmm. and but those kids, it felt like it's like y'all are kids that had to go to school online during COVID, and now y'all are like off to college, and y'all have to like learn how to be like socially interactive in person, and because they're all like, oh, I'm not used to people from a different planet and stuff, so they're
That's
all
a story
very
worth telling.
Yeah, it's a story worth telling, and it's something that I look forward to seeing in the Academy show probably next year. They're probably gonna start shooting that this year, and it might be out sometime next year.
I'm curious if it's going to take place on Earth or if it's the Academy is going to be like on that round disc shape.
But they moved their round disc station back to Earth at the end of season 4. So it'll either be, I think, on the ground or it'll be in orbit. It'll still be Earth based, I think, either way.
I'm just curious to be like, is this story going to take place in like Earth in San Francisco, or is it going to like actually like maybe it's like a moving school that just kind of like wanders around or something like that?
Yeah, it could be somewhere other than San Francisco.
I like both the idea of a grounded Earth-based thing, because you get to see all of it, gets to reintroduce Earth in the Star Trek canon and show us all what's been going on, and there is a certain literal groundedness that can be satisfying, and you know, it'll make the characters feel a little bit more down to Earth. But in the spirit of Discovery, the idea of a sort of roving, you know, school that, you know, could move around, and like, it's like, well, we're going to be studying this interesting solar event, and so we're going to actually literally go to it, or, you know, we're going to take you to meet some Tellarite ambassadors or something like that. I want to see a Tellarite teaching the kids how to swear. I want to see that.
We had that maybe one Tellarite the debate, did.
Their debate teacher, they're like debate coach or something.
Yes.
I actually hope we get more live-action Tellarites. Yeah. Like, I feel like we're missing that for a bit. Like, there, that one character, one of the cadets, was a Tellarite. So, like, yeah. I want more of Tellarites. Like,
especially after Strange New World Season 2. I really liked a couple of the Tellarites. Just how they looked in Strange New World Season 2. I want to see more of them.
Yeah, I think that the only ones, like, the main Tellarite characters that we have is just Jenkum. You know, if I'm Prodigy. Right.
Yeah.
Good character, though.
Yeah, he's really great. It's just like, I wish we get more Tellarites. I feel like that's the, like, we get so much of humans and Vulcans and a lot of...
Yeah, I'm gonna complain about that. That's one of my, something I'm disappointed in season 4, is that you talk a lot about Tellarites, but, you know, you don't show them very often.
Yeah, I mean, and Tellarite, like, what, Tellar Prime is the only, like, founding member that didn't leave the Federation, so I feel like we need to give Tellarites...
I like that, too. I like everyone else was leaving, and then the Tellarites were like, if all of y'all are going to abandon the Federation, I'm not going to... Like, you would think, like, oh, the Tellarites would be the first ones to break off, but they're like, oh, everyone else is breaking off, we're going to stay.
That's because they're all bluster on the surface, but they got heart, baby.
Yeah.
That would be an awesome thing to see. Like, I know it's not, those aren't main characters, but that'd be an awesome little background thing to see in season 5.
What about like least favorite things in the season? If you want to give Discovery some constructive criticism, what would you tell them not to do anymore?
I mean, I think I talked about it, which is just the really awkward like background crew.
Right. Yeah. We went over that. I think I struggled with some of the stuff in the casino planet, and I talked about like the last 6 episodes feeling too stretched out.
Yeah, I think some pacing problems here and there, but I feel like those are kind of like more minor things that like it's not gonna make or break the season, I feel like, but sure. Yeah, I think that's there is some pacing problem, and I don't think it's helped by them going on that weird hiatus in the middle of the season.
No, yeah, that really disrupted it. And then I was so on board with the mid-season finale with But to Connect. That was probably my favorite episode of the season, and then they make us wait months, and then they come back and I'm so concerned about, oh, now, like, Book and Burnham, they're going to be separate. They're going to be at odds against each other, and they're going to be, like, spending time away from one another. And then the next episode, it brought them together, and, like, here's wacky casino antics. And it was a very – that's the most disappointed I've ever been with, like, a mid-season premiere of a show I was really into.
Yeah, I feel like what they should have done, I felt like they should have put that – the mid-season hiatus to, like – an episode before, because I feel like what happened with like Book and Tarka taking off, and then like you said, they just kind of found them again, like I feel like that would feel a lot better if we didn't have that weird like 2-month wait in between. If they had put it like the episode before, which I think was them coming out of the rift, I think it would have worked better in terms of like just story momentum, because I felt like what happened when they placed that hiatus there, it just, like, it kind of killed the momentum of that story. Because it was going somewhere, and then it just kind of, like, fizzled. And then when they picked it back up, it just didn't feel the same.
Thankfully, season 5 t- 10 episodes released over 9 weeks. The first two will be both released on April 4th on Paramount Plus, and then no interruptions. So,
yeah.
Dave, did you have any other complaints about season 4?
You know, I think we touched on it. As far as like maybe being a little long, Father, am I correct that like how long was an average episode length? Did they sometimes top an hour?
I don't think so in season 4. Okay. A lot of them were shorter. I think it might have been like the shortest episodes.
Okay.
But Haz Mazzaro in the Casino Planet episode, like, I don't know, how disappointed would you be if season 5 opens where they go back to Haz Mazzaro and he's just saying like the annoying thing with him was like how everything he said had to be like, "Oh, it's like a Horton Hustle with a Cardassian cake," and just like, "I'm gonna scurry away like a spider cow." It's like, what the hell are you talking about, Haz Mazzaro? Like, and it gets worse and worse. He does it more and more as the episode goes on. You know,
was that? It sounds like an in joke. Like they were like, let's make him like talk as Star Trek-y as possible.
And sometimes he just says like made up words. It's not even like a Star Trek reference. He'll just be like, "Oh, it's like a little Zuzu Lazian," or just, he'll just like say gibberish. Just like,
but you know,
I look it up on like Memory Alpha. I'm like, what the hell are you even talking about, Haz Mazzaro? Like,
You know, I think I might enjoy that more on revisit, thinking as maybe was the case that they wanted to kind of push it over the top and like almost spoof the Trek tropes of like, you know, like an Aldebaran werecat, you know, where he's just, to the point where it's gibberish.
There's fun stuff in that episode. I do like Sonequa Martin-Green and David Ajala have really good chemistry. There's you know some fun stuff. It's fun to see them working together when they have to, you know, like we're at odds against each other, but we still have those familiar rhythms where we can teamwork it when we need to, you know.
It is such a kind of video game thing in a way, though, like the side quests, like you have to go and fight an arena and you have to like find card sharks.
Feels like the other Star franchise. It's like I'm watching Mandalorian or something, you know, but
I do like that that Book and Burnham, like I think that relationship is very emotionally mature, like incredibly so.
Even when they like how they reconcile after they're at odds, and
yeah.
I really appreciate
like,
that.
There is such like a maturity to their relationship where like how they interact with each other, and like even when they disagree and like really disapprove of each other, it's never in the sense that like they're trying to like one up each other, and like there's always this sort of like warmth and care and like this genuine like affection and respect for each other that like.
Right. You know, like, Book is like taking like a principled stance. He's not being petty.
Yeah, it's like whenever they interact, it's like they're always very clear to like make sure to let each other know that like, yeah, I don't agree with what you're doing, but I understand and I also still care about you. And I think it's like it would have been so easy in like I mean it's like in any story, it would have been so easy to do the like tropey, like I'm the jealous, you know, like I'm angry at you and I'll never speak to you again, like the melodrama. And I like that Book and Burnham's relationship is not that melodrama. It's like very mature, very like aware of each other.
On the season 4 Blu-ray, Sonequa Martin-Green talks about this, and keep in mind she's an executive producer on the show now and has influence, but she talks about how it was important for her to depict a healthy black romance on television.
Definitely.
And it still impresses me, like the chemistry that they have. They did not do any chemistry testing when they hired David Ajala. Like they didn't do any testing of him and Sonequa Martin-Green. That's just what they did, like with the guy that they hired when they put them together on set. But they are
good job,
so good together.
Casting director.
Yeah, the casting on Discovery has been pretty top notch. I love watching a lot of these people as these characters, and it's something I always look forward to. And just to close off on, you know, season 5, we're coming up on it. How do you feel now after refocusing on season 4, going into season 5, Pika? If you want to take it away,
I feel very mixed in the sense that like I'm both excited for where that story is going and kind of where everybody's journey is going. And maybe this coming season having a bit more of a, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark adventure feel. Just everybody kind of gets to go off and have fun discovering treasures around the galaxy. I think that's like, I feel like this crew of all the crews kind of deserve a little bit of just like, hey, everybody's going, running around, you know, doing fun stuff. And so I think that part is exciting to me, that like maybe this crew kind of gets to settle a bit more and just kind of like get to have fun and, you know, maybe not necessarily worry about the next incoming threat and just kind of go chase treasures for a while. And maybe that treasure is another dangerous object that will threaten the galaxy, but you know, they will still go and kind of have fun along the way. So I think that's the part I'm most excited about, but I'm also just like, it's kind of sad because I feel like we could definitely squeeze in 2 or 3 more seasons of them just running around the galaxy having fun. So, you know, I would wish for more. I personally hope, I mean, it's obviously not going to happen, but I would hope maybe they find seatbelts, you know, in this treasure hunt.
That's the one Star Trek thing they can never change. No.
The Kelvin timeline gave us seatbelts.
No. I was just like, maybe the Romulans, you know, I guess like they're chasing this whole Romulan ancient artifact or whatever, but like maybe the one thing the Romulans can give us is seatbelts. I'd like to think that. The one contribution. You know?
But then when the fireballs happen, if there's a fire that starts and you can't get out of your seatbelt.
Okay, maybe also remove whoever put all those blocks there in the consoles. That too is a problem, seemingly. No, so I don't know.
Exploding rocks, which they still have in the 32nd century. When Book is in his ship,
yeah,
and there's explosions on it, he's getting hit with rocks flying out of the. Even in the 32nd century, they still have exploding rocks come out of the computer.
This is programmable matter. I think it's on purpose. Maybe they just like they just really miss that like rocks hitting you feeling, so they program the matter to be like that as well. That's what I'm convinced of. Like they just really want to get hit.
It's their weird future fetish.
I'll say that's something I'm thinking about in season 5 though now is more exploding rocks flying around. But also it occurs to me, we were talking about, you know, they everyone gets along so well on Discovery. They all want to, you know, hug each other and get along and talk about how much they love each other, except when they have Giorgio or Tarka. I realize now, I think that our Romulan captain that we're getting in season 5, Captain Raynor, I think he's going to be maybe that role in season 5. So I'm looking forward to see.
But he's not captain of the Discovery.
No, he has his own ship.
Another ship that
they're working in conjunction with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds, I like that. I'm into that.
He's kind of like the what Vance's role sort of was in like season 3 when we first got to the Federation. He's probably the like main Federation presence from episode to episode that's kind of going to follow the crew around.
I hope that we have Vance too, though. I hope that we didn't lose him.
I think though he might be more like you know, keeping everybody on track, the boss in the background.
What about you, Dave? Let's close on what you think about season 5 now after revisiting season 4.
You know, I always find myself missing the characters, and it's kind of bittersweet. You know, I've mentioned it every time we talk about season 5 coming up, is that this show kicked off as you know, in preparation for Discovery after, you know, the long gap between, you know, Star Trek shows, the end of Enterprise. Obviously, we had the movies, but and so you know, just as like TOS holds a special place in my heart because reruns of that is what I grew up with, Discovery will always hold a special place in my heart because, you know, gave us this podcast and all these great fun interactions and stuff. So that's just like a purely kind of emotional connection to the show. But like, I love treasure hunt type things. like theoretically, like I've seen bad ones, but way back when I was a kid watching the G.I. Joe cartoon, in the early miniseries they did with them, it was common as a just plot device to have something that was like a device that Cobra had come up with that was scattered to the four corners of the Earth. And if they got it, they created a doomsday weapon. And so they would break up into teams and they'd all go hunting and battling each other. And, you know, obviously I love Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I even like National Treasure stuff too. So I like the genre. I think, as y'all were talking about it, I was thinking that Burnham's back, you know, her recent history as a courier feels like it could really come in handy in this little chase that they might have going on. And so I hope that, you know, that comes into play. She's got her connections and all that.
Do you think they're going to find the Declaration of Independence?
They need to break it out of, like, you know, a Borg, you know,
they go to some big library. They're in whatever that massive library in the trailer is.
Maybe the Romulans stole it, and now we have to steal it back, and that's, like, the main mission. It's just national treasure in space.
I will not mind at all seeing certain those tropes brought into, you know, a future context and see what kind of crazy stuff Discovery, because you know it's going to be like Mission Impossible type stuff probably too, but they're going to be like, well, we're going to have to use programmable matter, and we're going to have to like, you know, quantum teleport through their shields, and there's going to be all kinds of crazy stuff, and so that sounds promising to me. I hope, but also I like a good ending, and I know that I gather they did not know until they had to do some reshoots to when they found out that this would be the final season. And so I know it will not be building all throughout the whole season as if, oh, this is our last one, this is our last hurrah, which in a way is good, you know, to not be too self-conscious about that. But I hope they wrap it well. And I also, you know, I don't want anybody to get an ending that I don't like. So there's some apprehension, too. But yeah, that's kind of where I am right now.
Do you think they'll mention Calypso?
I don't know if Calypso will be explained.
Is that the far-flung future thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay, though, because now we know Zora can dream, so Calypso is probably just a dream.
That could be a smart way to explain things.
Yeah, like, all they need her to do is just say, like, I have weird dreams. I had a dream about this guy named Kraft one time, or just something like that.
But if they don't,
if they don't, it's still in my headcanon.
They didn't know it was their final season, though, so it's you know. But they're going to obviously be doing more with Zora, so maybe.
Yeah, she could show up in the Academy or be mentioned, who knows. But yeah, that's stuff that we'll find out soon. We'll be discovered out. We'll be all discovered. It'll be like Picard. It'll be like it came and went and now it's gone. And it's a retired Star Trek show. And we're just months away from that being a reality. So very bittersweet indeed. But it'll be a fun journey. We're going to be doing a lot of fun stuff in the build up to Disco's final season premiering on April 4th, and then we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it, I think.
Someone mentioned in the chat about having Nick Cage on Discovery Season 5.
He said recently that
he wants
Star
to be in Trek, so...
They should get him just to film a cameo where he's running away with the Declaration of Independence.
You know, I feel like way they had... is it Magnificent Ferengi? They had the rock guy, Iggy Pop. Same way they had him under all a ton of makeup, almost... invisible in the role, except still very clearly him. I think they should throw him in, rival treasure hunter or something like that. That would be cool. He'd do it, right? Get him in there.
Well, maybe that'll happen on one of these shows, and then we'll talk about it. But next week, a report from the South by Southwest premiere of Discovery Season 5. And until then, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.